Welcome to the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast. Sunday, December 22nd, 2013, episode 48, The Winter Wonderland. Hi everyone, my name is Kevin England, and I'd like to welcome you to another edition of the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast. It's an unseasonably warm day today here in New Jersey, almost 70 degrees Fahrenheit, and it's the end of December, go figure. It is the holiday season here in the U.S., and I'm happy to report that I'm actually off from work for the rest of the year. I have a few meetings to check in on, but unlike last year where I worked through the entire break, this year I'm stepping away to enjoy some much-needed time away. So it's only been a few days, but I'm already somewhat recharged and looking forward to getting some quality time with my family and catching up on some projects that I'd like to get to. One such endeavor is this episode, and without any further delay, it seems like a good time to get to the agenda of what we're going to talk about. Given that it's wintertime, it seems a good notion to revisit a bit about how our girls overwinter during these cold months. That will be our feature for this episode. There's a new prospect on how to control the varroa mite, and surprisingly, this is a fight fire with fire, something that you'll understand in a few moments. Later on in the program, we'll talk about an integrated pest management primer and run through a plethora of roundtable odds and ends to finish off the episode. First, let's take a brief moment to discuss the local hive report. Four hives on the property, and all four of them are flying today. Who knew that we'd get such a warm winter break here at the end of December? There's a large front coming up from the south, bringing in tropical moisture. It's very wet outside. We've had all the windows open and just kind of airing the house out, but everything's a little bit damp. Still, had an opportunity to walk the dog and go out and take a look at the hives, and all four of them were flying. You could see them doing cleansing flights and just flying around in general. We knew it was going to be a day for flying, as this morning when I was standing at the kitchen sink looking out the window, it cracked the window open a little bit, and the first one that greeted me was a honeybee, so that was pretty exciting. It's maybe the first or second time since the winter freeze has set in where they've had a chance to get out and fly. And as you know, if you've listened to past episodes, two of our hives are a little bit light in stores, but they're still functioning and still flying, so we're good to go there. I guess we'll continue to keep an eye on them, and come spring we'll feed them if we have to, but for the most part, a very welcome sight to see all hives in operation today. So that's it for the local hive report. Before I dive into our first feature, I wanted to take a moment and share our contact information. Our website, of course, is www.bkcorner.org, and you can send me an email at that address, kevin@bkcorner.org. I have a Facebook page, facebook.com/beekeeperscorner. When you're not listening to episodes, you can check in there, as we're posting things every once in a while there to keep the odds and ends that people send me and things that I find flowing. And it's always a bunch of interesting features there. I spent a moment recently on my iPad from work looking at Flipboard and at our channel and looking through the number of things that have been posted there over time. And there's a lot of interesting features there. I'm surprised at the massive collection that happens over time as you periodically keep posting things. So go check that out if that's an interest, facebook.com/beekeeperscorner. Also, you could check out the YouTube channel that we post for the Northwest New Jersey Beekeepers Association and that I curate. Currently working on a feature for mead making, and we'll have that up in the coming days. That is youtube.com/NWNJBA. A lot of interesting videos there. And that's about it. Let's get started here. We'll go to segment number one, Fight Fire with Fire. I call this segment, May the Best Mite Win. Some recent coverage brings an interesting twist to our frustrating varroa mite problem. Researchers are working on a tactic to use mites to combat mites. A mite has been identified that works on preying on Varroa mites. This mite is called Strelelaps crimitus and was discovered in British Columbia, Canada by Dr. Dave Gillespie and his partner Dr. Quinn. This mite is sold as a biological control for some 25 years and has a number of uses. It is described as a generalist soil predatory mite, and it's used for gnat control, strawberry and cactus root weevil control, beetle and nematode pest control, and many other applications. One such application is to use this control as a pest against the black vine weevil. This particular pest damages plants and is akin to a lawn grub. As the Varroa is a pest to us, this is the bane of the nursery industry. The mites here feed on the larvae of the weevil and provide relief. The mites find this food and swarm in to feed on the larvae, and the nursery industry is looking to use this like we might use it to consider for hives. These mites have been in use in the United States for years to control cricket mites that affect tarantulas, pest mites in snake cages, and even for mites that affect hermit crabs. Greenhouses have been using these mites to control spider infestations, and we as beekeepers may see the benefit of introducing them into our hives to control Varroa. It's kind of a surprise to me that these have been out there and applied in these other ways and that someone didn't bring this up earlier for beekeeping, but all the better. So I won't get ahead of myself, as maybe your reaction is a bit like mine. Let's be careful here and not get into the situation of fixing one problem and causing two more. Frankenstein applications of a good thing can lead to Godzilla, after all. The mite could, for example, consider consuming the larvae instead of the mite. There's a rewarding video on the internet showing these little mites ganging up on a Varroa mite and bringing it to its joyous demise. Scientists are looking into the application of these mites, which one could pick up in a package and dump into a hive. A bottle of mites is about 25,000 mites, and these females lay 2 to 3 eggs per day and consume about 1 to 5 prey a day. Big numbers do a big job. So I'll provide a video link about the trial going on with beehives, and I strongly encourage you to watch it. Sorry for the spoilers, but they dumped these mites into the hive and the bees recognized the mites. They went to them and they took them to the brood. As a side note, they explained that when these are used with hermit crabs, the crabs will actually go to the mites and give them a free ride, knowing the beneficial role they play. There's hints in the video that the bees may actually be going to these mites too after observing the way they work in the hives. And the scientists are watching this through microscopes. Interesting stuff. So here's another little tidbit. These mites not only took up the quest against the mites, the Varroa mites, but they also cleared up the detritus in the hives, and it was noted by the beekeepers and the scientists that the hives were more active, cleaner internally, and seemed to be stronger in operation. There were mite body parts and shells along the bottom board, and I have to tell you, I'm really excited about this, and here's why. There's a thread on the BeeSource forum about this topic, and it was Michael Bush that pointed out that mites were always in hives. We tried to kill off mites by gassing the interiors, and who knew what the collateral damage was? We inadvertently adjust the ecosystem inside, and potentially we could have upset the apple cart. If it is true, then perhaps this isn't the potential for science experiment gone wrong, but something nature may have intended and we're interfering with it. I suppose I won't get ahead of myself, and with stuff like this, I'd hate to be an early adopter or rogue and start ordering this stuff over the web and dumping it in my hives without letting the entomologists the proper time to assess the potential impacts. If science gets to a comfortable place about this, and the science is sound and not risky, who knows? We might have the solution that we've been longing for. It is, however, a long path, and I also know that there are other equally promising solutions in the works. For those longtime listeners, remember our Line in the Pan segment about hive beetles? Well, they're using that same approach with varroa mite, and that too has a ton of promise in my eyes. And it is being commercially investigated for mite and hive beetle control. So all good stuff, I say, and I suspect that this will really gain traction in 2014 as the beekeeping circles latch onto it, and this is an interesting prospect that you can't help get excited about. In my mind, biocontrol of the varroa mites makes more sense than putting insecticides and acaricides in a box of insects. I guess we can dream for a worry-free solution for now. To see the video I referenced and for links to other items we cover in this episode, visit our website and see the show notes for episode number 48. Again, our website is www.bkcorner.org. For segment number two, I wanted to do something on wintering, a refresh, so to speak, and we call this one Winter Wonderland, hence the title of the episode. If you've been a beekeeper for any length of time, then you probably become known as the guy or gal that keeps bees in your traveled circles. Depending upon how many people you come in contact with, this may or may not be a memorable topic for them. And if you're anything like me, you're often asked how your bees are doing. It becomes a routine question, but when cold weather comes, the natural curiosity of people comes out, and the question changes from how are your bees to what happens to your bees during the winter. People genuinely don't know the concept that honeybees overwinter in a cluster in the hive. We've covered the fundamentals of how bees overwinter in episode 11, titled The Heat Is On, and truth be told, that was one of my favorite segments in any episode, and given that it is now winter, and it was so long ago, I thought it would be interesting to go back over the basics of how bees overwinter and expand upon the insights to complement the topic. We covered the basics of how bees overwinter in episode 11, titled The Heat Is On. And truth be told, that was one of my favorite segments of any episode that we've done so far. Given that it is winter, and that was so long ago, I thought it would be interesting to go back over the basics on how bees overwinter and expand upon the insights to complement the topic. So first, a couple fundamentals. Bees do indeed overwinter. And even though they have a tropical origin, they do quite fine overwintering, even in locales where the thermometer dips below 0 degrees Fahrenheit. It seems there's an opportunity to say this in every show lately, but it's not cold that kills bees, it's moisture. And we also say that this will come up a little bit later in the segment. In a roundabout way, winter preparations for the bees start in the middle of the nectar flow in the spring. Three fundamental principles get your bees into an overwinter state. They need an adequate number of bees, they need stores, and they need a functional queen. Late spring and early summer set the bees on their destiny to the first frost and the days that fall below 60 degrees Fahrenheit and kick in the clustering mechanism for survival in the cold. An adequate number of bees means that you have a superorganism workforce to keep the cluster temperatures in the proper zone until warmer days come. If your hive is riddled with mites in the summer and crosses a threshold that impacts the emerging bees, well, that's a recipe for that hive to collapse just before the creation of winter bees in late summer and early fall. Bees, you see, will ramp down at some point after the summer solstice, and if you have sick emerging bees and or sick adult bees, then you will not have a healthy colony to change over to winter bees. Colony health is the overarching rule in the formula for success for hives next spring. A tired, worn-out queen is an obvious factor for concern and a topic for another show. Adequate stores to overwinter are another thing altogether. As we've discussed in recent episodes, your best bet for success is to have a bee-obtained stores of pollen and nectar and not a fabricated load-in that you provide. Ideally, it is a pollen and nectar source from nature as it was intended and not sugar solutions poured from a paper bag or supplemental pollen, as that's just not the same thing. I suppose you can get by with that formula, and let me not be snobbish about this, but I don't think there's anyone out there that could argue that natural forage is superior. So let me quit this as if you're a listener of these shows, these insights are not new news. Bees start to get into a cluster formation at 57 degrees Fahrenheit, or for our international listeners, 14 degrees Celsius. This means that they will gather together in the brood area and produce heat that keeps everyone warm. The term for this is ectothermic. Ectothermic relates to an organism that regulates its body temperature largely by exchanging heat with its surrounding environment. The bees are said to be thermogenic, a term that means they are heat-producing, and the combination of producing heat, transferring it amongst the cluster, and trapping it allow the bees to overwinter. This is referred to as a heat entrapment model, and the hypothesis that the bees will maintain thermal stability and a high core temperature. So bees can generate heat by shivering. Yeah, it's kind of like the shivering we know, but there's not really that trembling in the cluster. It's a bit different per se, as they are not really moving, but their flight muscles are doing all the work in what I affectionately call bee aerobics. As it gets colder, the cluster takes a more formal shape. The cluster size correlates to the number of bees in the hive. If one thinks about the biology of the bees, there's a brood nest 24/7, and the brood chamber is kept to a temperature of 89 to 97-ish degrees Fahrenheit. Yes, all year long, the brood chamber has to be kept at temperature to keep the brood viable. To envision the cluster, picture an oblong disc or blob where the shape is like a flying saucer, grapefruit-sized to the size of a basketball or bigger. But the trick is it's not round like a circle, but more like a flattened disc like someone squished it. It's not as wide as it is tall, or tall as it is wide, and it's not necessarily horizontal or vertical. It's as the bees want it. The brood is at the center of this mass, and for descriptive purposes, I always like to describe it like the composition of the earth. The earth has a crust and an outer mantle, which makes up its exterior. The inner core is at the center, and it's surrounded by an outer core and a middle mantle. In our model, the brood is at the core, and the nurse bees are in the outer core. Here the bees are able to move around to do their work. They are in and out of the cells, and of course the queen is in this area. Nurse bees and worker bees take care of brood and feeding bees. Typical hive activities in the brood chamber as they go on all year long. The middle mantle is where the heater bees are. From the middle mantle to the outside crust, the bees are together, meaning shoulder to shoulder and facing the core. These are the bees that are doing bee aerobics and generating heat. They transfer and maintain the heat to the core and surrounding areas through direct bee-to-bee transfer and literally going into the cells and transference through the wax walls. This is how they keep the brood viable through the wax. They also obviously give off heat like a little radiator, and they are doing that through consuming body mass and any food that is provided to them or available to them inside the cluster space. Now, one wouldn't want that heat to be wasted, so the bees on the outside, outer mantle, and the periphery bees of the crust are bound together and keeping that heat from escaping. The efficiency of this is not to be underestimated, as the ability to maintain heat has been compared to the fur of an animal in keeping the heat from escaping. It was originally thought that the bees on the outside generated the heat, but that has been proven false. A Kevin moment. I'm not sure why scientists had to rationalize this. It seems so obvious. Heating at the exterior would not be in the spirit of the bees, as everything they do has a purpose to it, and if they were heating the outside, well, that would just be wasteful as the heat would immediately be lost to the surrounding air. End of Kevin moment. The bees perform different duties and circulate throughout the cluster. Sometimes the bee will heat, then it will go to the surface and cool off. They are all there working 24/7 on hive activities and working towards those warm days. Okay, with the introduction out of the way, let's discuss a few other dynamics going on to get our ladies through the winter. I mentioned earlier that preparations start long before the first frost. To overwinter, bees have to generate heat and keep brood warm. So logically, the more brood, the harder the job. Bees have evolved to understand that it is to their advantage to ramp down the brood in anticipation of winter. You might think, well, if they have less bees, then how do they keep enough bees coming to live through winter? Older bees will die, and new bees won't emerge to replace them. So how does that work? Winter bees is the answer. Bees that will have to live months change their body makeup and, as noted in episode 11, start packing on Vitagelin and go through other changes in preparation for a move to winter. Newly emerged bees that overwinter have significantly greater dry weight, protein, fat, triglycerides, glycogen, and glucose content than bees that do not survive the winter. The smaller brood chamber means they don't have to maintain as much surface warmth during the colder months and would not need as much fuel to keep that brood chamber warm. It is a delicate balance of bees, stores, brood, and queen cooperation that they have somehow evolved to do, and it can't hardly be explained. The trigger that causes this colony to begin this winter state during late summer, early fall is unknown, but it has been hypothesized that it is tied to the summer solstice and the declining light as fall progresses. This phenomena may also kick in one other change, and that is from gatherers to overwinter bees. Forage declines in the fall and when the brood starts to ramp down result in less bees to care for. Cessation of nursing is one of the factors believed to trigger the switchover of bees to overwinter bees in early fall. So bees have to conserve, and they have to adjust their metabolic rate accordingly. It is said that hives' metabolic rate is lowest when the thermostat is hovering around 15 degrees Fahrenheit or 5 degrees Celsius. There are some places that are so cold to keep the bees that beekeepers move their bees into a shelter. The guidance there is about ventilation and wrapping the bees and keeping them in a temperature in a building at 14 degrees Fahrenheit. This allows them to maintain the lowest metabolic burn. It stands to reason that bees overwinter with only the stores that they have in hand. They don't get the opportunity to go out and forage, and in colder climates, they wouldn't find anything anyway. It should be noted that bees can go outside of the hive on cold days. I remember last year seeing them out on the snow, but once they get chilled, they lose their ability to fly. If the thorax cools below the chill coma temperature of 15 degrees Fahrenheit, that's about 9 to 11 degrees centigrade, honeybees are no longer able to activate their flight muscles for heating. They can walk, but there's no direct way to walk back to the cluster to recover their toast. So that being said, occasionally a bee can make a cleansing flight because most locations see some form of a warm day every once in a while, but bees close down their metabolisms for the long haul, usually over winter. There is, of course, another thing to consider about these long spells. They can't defecate in the hive, and it would do no good to consume all their stores and then have to go out and, you know. Bees should go into winter with 3 to 6 well-filled frames of pollen so they could feed their brood, especially as spring approaches, but they're not in there chowing down every day. They learn to prep for winter by adjusting their body structures and are able to draw off of the stores of protein from their bodies in order to supplement feeding the brood. Now, clusters do move around inside the hive cavity, but the brood is always cared for, and it doesn't get chilled. They will move slowly to the resources, and mostly move up and slightly sideways, but are not known for moving down to stores below them. We provided this insight on a recent episode. Up for honey stores makes sense for the premise that heat rises and it makes the honey above the cluster consumable. Cold honey below them, if there is such a thing, is probably not viable. A honeysuckle, anyone? Moisture kills bees. You probably know that about now. But have you considered that for every 2 pounds of honey consumed by the bees, they produce about 1.2 pounds of water? This is a big deal in the winter because of the moisture escaping inside the chamber, encountering cold surfaces, and eventually condensing. If the bees ate all of the honey during the cold periods, it would be warm enough to consume, but that vapor hitting the surfaces, meaning condensation, and condensation in cold temperatures freezes on the inside surfaces and on the combs, and the bees die. Of course, the classic thing that everybody talks about is water raising up through the hive, condensing on the inner lid, dripping cold water back down, and it immediately kills a bee that it lands on. Now, this doesn't mean that cold winters are bad. In fact, I always rationalize that a cold winter is a good winter. Optimally, you want a winter that is not bone-chilling cold, but cold enough to slow the bees down metabolically, and they'll nestle in. A few years ago, we had an unseasonably warm winter, and that was just plain frustrating. The bees were more active than they should have been, and consumed more stores than usual because of that activity. With warmer winter, bees will sometimes go out and find pollen, but most of the time, they'll come up empty-handed, and warm weather kind of throws them off balance. That's my personal observation, and I'm always happy when we have a relatively normal, cold winter. If anything, there is another dynamic that beekeepers welcome with cold winters, and that is the chill also helps to freeze those less desirable insects that can't survive in the cold Northeast. For example, that same warm winter provided us with more hive beetles in the summer than we would have liked to have seen, and I would speculate it was because the ground didn't get a good hard freeze. One can help bees make it through the winter, and sometimes I would figure, given what was discussed, help them too much. Wrapping hives with tar paper, for example, passively warms the colonies on sunny winter days and causes them to break their cluster at lower ambient temperatures than normal. The ambient temperature, the temperature it is outside, is sometimes a good regulator, and we're working against that in some ways by artificially heating the hives. Now, I guess I will take this all with a grain of salt, as bees are supposed to be in a tree and they have a cambium that is supposed to maintain some form of temperature swing control, and our boxes are made of 3/4-inch wood with an R factor of 1. I'm kind of in the camp that less is more, and maybe wrapping our hives is something we shouldn't be bothering with, but there is one thing I believe in, and I don't know that I would go into winter doing something different, and that is a quilt box. Moisture kills bees, yep. Something that absorbs moisture and gives that moisture back to the environment, not inside the hives, I think is the one extra step I could advocate to anybody. If you think about it, in a feral hive, they're inside the cavity, and whatever they're working on is dropping as detritus into the bottom of the cavity, and that tends to absorb moisture. It's very similar to, perhaps, a nature-made quilt. And I think when you put a quilt box on the top with newspaper or leaves or straw or whatever substrate you put in, it's advantageous that it absorbs the moisture coming through the top of the hive, holds on to it, and then it eventually dries out and gives it back. Hopefully you have vents or something that allows it to dissipate, but not condense and drip down onto the bees. For us, trying to derive methods to maintain the heat inside the colony is probably not as important as providing proper moisture control and ventilation. In fact, as I said before, if you heat the hives too much, they'll be active, and you really want them to go into that dormant state. But I guess you have to figure out where you are and what your climate is as to how you behave. I'm sure that there are certain parts in the northern United States or Canada where you have no choice but to put them inside to protect them. So you have to take into consideration what the local practices are from your location. So I talked about moisture. Let's talk about ventilation. There was a research article that had this in it. Quote, a study from northern Alberta, for example, demonstrated that either a 1 by 1.5 centimeter top entrance built into an inner cover or a 2.5 centimeter diameter hole drilled in the middle of an upper brood box greatly increased colony strength, health, and decreased the consumption of honey stores. So given that I'm in the United States, the centimeter thing doesn't have much perspective to me. So translating that into inches, it would be a 2/5 to 3/5 inch opening for the top entrance, or a drilled opening of about 1 inch in the middle of the upper brood box. You know, to me, 1 inch seems like a big hole, but I've seen hives with this opening in them and always wondered why people did that. It must have been some sort of past practice. To me, a 3/4 inch or smaller hole seemed practical enough, and I have a 1/2 inch by 3/4 inch notch in my hives, and I know by observation that the bees close that off some with propolis. Occasionally, when they want it bigger, they just chew out a little propolis, and they regulate how much air comes in and out of that opening and what size hole it will be. I've heard that our hives are a bit different than a tree, and when bees coat them with propolis and seal them up, they become enclosed. Maybe too much so when it comes to the Langstroth variant. I've seen recommendations that beekeepers should crack the seals to introduce ventilation. Me? I'm of the mind that this is crazy talk. The bees know what they want, and if they didn't want to seal it up, they would leave it that way. My way of thinking is that you leave the hives be until you get the warmer weather, and don't crack those propolis seals until the bees have their leeway to break the cluster and move around. So bees make it through the hard part, and spring is in sight. What happens then? This is an area we'll focus on in our upcoming episodes, and it seems we could use more insights on how to better prepare our girls for a successful run to the bounties of spring. That will be the focus of our next couple sessions. Bees will consume remaining stores coming out of winter twice as fast as they do in the colder months. The queen will get to work raising that spring workforce, and so unfortunately will the varroa that overwintered in the hive. This is another foreshadow of a topic we have upcoming in one of our episodes. So now it's starting to warm up, you're getting occasional warm days, and the hives are starting to hum. The girls are coming out of slumber, and they're peeking their heads outside, and on those warm days, they're getting over to those areas of the hive that were just out of reach of the cluster. It is in late winter and early spring that a cluster has some leeway to move around. Now they'll move side to side early in the winter, but they won't venture too far from the center of the box. In the spring, they'll move up in the honey dome and more side to side as the weather breaks, and hopefully will find the bounty that they need to produce the spring bees. This is where, incidentally, Kevin Moment, I think we went wrong last year. If you hearken back to a couple episodes, you know that we did not feed our bees in the fall. They had a good fall-winter flow, and they made it a fall-nectar flow, and they made it through to spring, but when they got to the good weather, they didn't have a lot to eat, and they did not come out strong. And I think that is quintessential to what happened last spring when our hives got a very slow start. Anyway, end of Kevin Moment. So I was saying they move up towards the honey dome and they can move right or left. And an interesting study shows that bees will actually move around inside the box to where the warmth is. If the sun is on the south side, the cluster could move to that wall and take advantage of the radiant heat coming through the wood. when the sun sets, they'll go back to the central area. But make no mistake, they always keep that brood chamber in working order. This is the thing that frustrates beekeepers. Hives starve sometimes, and they are only inches away from stores. They won't abandon that brood, and succumbing is more of a sign of not enough bees to generate the warmth needed and to have the ability to stretch and be elastic inside there to move to the stores that is around them. So in the winter and early spring, the cluster will have seen its casualties for bees that gave it their all, but if the size of the group was big enough, they can reshape the cluster around the brood and reach out to those periphery areas and pull in the stores. This is where you, as a beekeeper, will have earned your keep if you went into winter with the right resources in the hive. If not, perhaps you can intervene here with supplemental feed, but if it's still cold, it will have to be in proximity of the brood chamber. Now, I know I just said a moment ago not to break the seals, but look, if they're going to starve, what good does that do you? Open up the hive, do emergency feed over the cluster, and close things up. You can tape the seams between the box to help matters if you have to break the clusters. So checking the hives in the spring is a reasonable activity, and a quick heft of the colony should be able to give you a sign. And that's all you really need to do to know whether they're out of stores. You don't literally have to be cracking the boxes open. Now, if you see bees heading out in the first breaks of spring, bringing back pollen, the chances are that things are in good order and there's nothing to see here, so stay out of your hives. Get them to the skunk cabbage, crocus, and other early blooming plants in spring, and life is good. Mission accomplished. It's been a long and quiet winter for the girls, and they're ready to get to work. Now, they've lost some mates along the way, but new bees will emerge at an ever-increasing rate, and it will be your time to get things in order for a bountiful spring. Winter is certainly a great time for bees and beekeepers. While bees still have to maintain a viable colony, they're kind of getting a time to rest and refresh, and come bursting through spring with a new invigorated workforce. We, too, get a nice break during winter, and there's nothing that puts a smile on a beekeeper's face than the first blooms of spring. It's late December, and the awakening is right around the corner. Segment number 3, Integrated Pest Management. There are times when you hear the researchers and presenters talk about integrated pest management. This is also referred to as IPM, and at its core, integrated pest management is an approach that uses a combination of techniques in an organized manner to suppress pests effectively, economically, and in an environmentally sound manner. As beekeepers, we aspire to practice IPM techniques by using screen bottom boards, sticky traps, nematodes, and in some cases, chemical and biological controls. The first line of defense is to pick a resistant bee to our biggest nemesis, the varroa mite, so it stands to reason that breeders are picking stocks of bees that show the best prospects for controlling it naturally. The term varroa-sensitive hygiene, or VSH, is often used to describe bee stocks that have been selected as part of a pest control program. In our case, we can approach IPM more holistically by following certain practices. We monitor for mites and hive beetles with the intention of understanding if they are present and what the population levels are. We educate ourselves to the impact thresholds and design treatments or corrective actions based on the biology of the pest we are trying to control. Now, one should note that I did use the word control. I didn't say eradicate. It's unreasonable for beekeepers to expect that any silver bullet, no matter what IPM program you have in place, is going to be true. In some respects, and we've talked about this here before, we want the bees to learn to live with these pests and let nature sort it out so we can stop worrying about these things. IPM monitoring is the first step in an essential IPM program. Make a commitment to design and execute a monitoring program in your apiary. Figure out what methods you'll use and set up your schedule. Allow enough time in your yard work to stay on top of this task and finish the job. And of course, leave time in the schedule to respond to any reactions that are necessary as a result of your findings. You know, this is kind of a sneaky thing in a good beekeeper program because many beekeepers simply underestimate the level of efforts these activities take and don't build time to manage the apiary. I know I'm kind of guilty of that sometimes because of other pressures in my life, and quite frankly, it's very stressful to me. I plan on going in with a fresh approach in 2014 and setting my mind to build time in my schedule to stay on top of these things starting this spring. I'd love to be treatment-free, but this takes the guesswork out of the equation. I'll do my least intrusive monitoring, and if the threshold is present, I'll have a preordained plan of action. I have this to say for those who do not want to treat. Knock yourselves out. They're your bees, and it's your money and your hard-earned labor. Please be kind to your neighbors, but you can be pragmatic about these things and potentially go the no-treat way. In my experience, when you have an infestation of mites, there isn't any good will in the world that will allow your hives to recover. I think that is the primary lesson I've learned in 2013, having talked to so many beekeepers on this topic across the year. So, a good IPM program is constantly evolving. One thing is for sure, one treatment doesn't fit all. Let me know if this rings a bell with you. I'm afraid that a lot of beekeepers are just too smitten with MitAway quick strips. Convenient, nuclear in strength, can be used when honey is on. What's not to love about these things? But whatever mite survives that treatment, they're the ones that breed from here on in. Treat them again, and guess what? They might scoff at the notion. Use something else instead, and you will get them in a different way. Switch to a third product or method, and hopefully you'll decimate any mites or beetles that got past the first two. Staying with a one-trick pony, and you're developing super mites. Just as important as it is to pick the right treatment, the timing is critical. I plan to do a feature upcoming on timing of suppression methods, but suffice it to say, taking care of mites and or beetles at the right time, or any other pests that you have in your hive, is as critical as treating them in the first place. Some take the approach to hit, run, hit, run, hit, run, and keep the populations in check over a steady stream. Others will let them get to critical mass and then go on the offensive. Some techniques are actually more suitable to what you do with your bees. So let me say that another way to you. Commercial beekeepers will use different tactics than, say, a person who has two hives out in the side yard. Commercial guys, for example, have different objectives. They may need to get their bees to one place here and then make the timing for another place here where you're not moving your bees whatsoever. Do your reconnaissance and come up with the IPM program that suits you. So some of the tools that you have in your arsenal, in no particular order, screen bottom boards, acaricides, which are mite treatments, they kill mites, that's what acaricide stands for. These are the chemical products that kill them, that's an option for you. Sticky board traps, beetle traps, powdered sugar treatments, more on that later. Caging the queen to break the brood cycle so the population of drones is diminished and less mites are reproduced in the cells. Performing splits on your hives. Heating the frames using equipment designed to raise the temperature that kills mites. So actually, this is probably not a widespread concept, but an interesting concept nonetheless. Mites, by biology, will die at a certain temperature. You can heat the inside of the hive to kill the mites, but one has to be careful as it's only a few more degrees and you start killing the brood. I guess that would stop the mites too, but that's not really the goal with this technology. There are persons like Zachary Wang, I think he's from Michigan, that have created this device that lets you heat the frames up, and five times a year you heat your hive up, and then the mites go away. Interesting, but I don't think fully baked yet, or we'd see it more commercially. Another popular technique is drone brood culling. So I heard something interesting on this, and this is where you cut the drone brood out and discard it. It's highly effective because we know 90% of the mites are inside the drone brood. But the perspective is that it takes a lot of resource for the colony to manufacture a frame of drones. As it was said, think of all the honey and pollen consumed to make a frame of bees. And if you're cutting these things out, 3 or 4 frames a season, you're using frames and frames and frames of your honey. Now, I personally think this is a reasonable trade-off, and it's an interesting perspective at the cost of achieving mite control, but I always still have that perspective. If they're building drones, there's something else going on. They need them. Especially if they're building a lot of them. Is your queen at fault or is something going on? You know, these are things to consider as part of your program. You could pull frames out and freeze them. That's another IPM method. And the last one I'll give you is feeding spiked sugar solutions that can make the bee hemolymph less palatable to mites. So I can't say that I've ever heard this being done in practice. I've heard about it theoretically. And people talk frequently about different concoctions that they make in their sugar solutions. The premise of this is it's like an acaricide, but from within inside the bee. Now the bee that the mite latched onto, it would die or get sick because it's being vectored viruses. But that mite, sucking on whatever it is inside the bee, would be impacted by dying from it or being sterilized or something like that. And if you can keep that mite from reproducing, it will drop the population of mites in the colony. That's interesting, and you've won the war. So I'd be curious to see if we can find out more about this particular technique and whether anybody's doing it. If you know of anybody or you've seen anything in your travels, send us a note. So I'm kind of riffing on ideas here, and there's probably others, and maybe some completely oblivious ones that I've left off. But I think you get the gist that integrated pest management for bees has a myriad of options, and the key to an effective one is to have a plan. If you want to send me suggestions for ones that I've missed, you can send me a note at kevin@bkcorner.org. So it's time for us to turn the corner and move into our roundtable section of the podcast. This is where we bring you a rapid-fire succession of a number of various topics. The first one starting off, mite drop-off. I'm always looking at potential articles to bring to the show, and lately I found a number of items on the Varroa mite. One thing that stuck with me from the Hershey American Beekeeping Federation conference was the assertion that screen bottom boards are not really working. It was professed that mites don't fall off bees, and therefore screen bottom boards are a gimmick. This falls into direct contrast with my observation about the mites being on the sticky boards in the first place. So given the assertion, I've kind of had an ear to the ground about whether or not there is truth to this, or there's some sort of middle ground, and it is still a good idea to use screen bottom boards. So I recently read a post on BeeSource from Michael Bush with his assertions that bees do have mites that fall off and screens are advantageous. In another respect, what he was talking about in the thread was that if treating takes place and a mite falls off but doesn't die, on a solid bottom board, they have time to recover and then get back on the bee. These are interesting thoughts. But back to the point, still, screen bottom board conundrum, is it effective? I found the answer, and it's been included in a number of research papers I've found recently. One such example is an October 2012 paper from Zachary Wong out of the Department of Entomology, Michigan State University. It has the best summary of what I believe to be true about Varroa and screen bottom boards. It says the mite is phoretic about 5 to 11 days. Phoretic means that it's mobile on the insect. The mite is living on its host, the honeybee. Sometimes you'll see the mite on top of the bee, but most times it will be out of view on the underside and tucked in between the intersegmental membrane on the abdomen. Think about the segments on the back of the bees. They are tucked into the greases in those sections on the underside. That's just plain speak about where the mite is often hitching a ride. And it's in there where you can't see it underneath the bee as it's walking on the comb. As it says in the paper, mites change hosts. They hop from one bee to another. This contributes to the transmission of viruses that the mites carry. Sometime in this transfer, they will fall off. Sometimes during grooming, bees bite them and they fall off, or other times they die and fall off because of old age. To me, that's an interesting notion. How many of the mites do we catch on the bottom board that are not there because of good circumstance, but only because they were dead and fell off, having inflicted all of the damage they were going to do? That is a sad state of affairs, and it is the majority of what we find on the bottom board, incidentally. The point that I see quoted over and over again is whatever you find on the bottom board, it represents less than 20% of the total population of mites in the hive. The conclusion is that screen bottom boards alone will not take care of your problems, and the assertions from ABF ring true. The effectiveness of a screen bottom boards might be smoke and mirrors after all. For this, I'll provide a link to Varroa Mite Reproductive Biology where you can look up additional information on this. For round table number 2, we're going to talk about powdered sugar dusting. And no more snow bees for me. Okay, I say uncle on this one. I've been a fan of using powdered sugar as an integrated pest management practice for quite some time now, and I've always said that unless something comes along that provides contrary evidence, I would still consider it as a potential technique for mite control. So recently, I've run across a bunch of tangential mentions of its effectiveness, and it has reshaped my thoughts on this. And recently, I watched a presentation from Jamie Ellis that convinced me that this method is not as viable as I once thought. Actually, it was this last one coupled with other facts that has me rethinking the prospects of using this as a method for mite control. So that being said, all of the things that made it appealing to me in the first place, no mite resistance, inexpensive, easy to apply, somewhat effective, all still hold true and are core to an IPM way of doing things. There is one aspect of the science, however, that has not proven to be factually accurate. It was said that the temperature of the bees inside the hives would cause the sugar to melt, they would get, for lack of a better description, greasy, and the mites would slip off. So maybe this is true and maybe it's not. But Jamie Ellis' video talked about the research that indicated even when putting them in a box that just sits there and shakes them, these mites are not detaching from the bee. Couple that with the fact that most mites are in with the brood, and specifically the drones, it seemed like the screen bottom boards, you know, topic that we just talked about, there's not a lot to see here. And the last piece of the puzzle is about doing the least interruption to the interior of the colony and its operations. Dusting the bees is about as disruptive as can be, so even though I'm a laggard in joining the ones who already figured this practice out, it should possibly be shelved unless we could find a more effective means for doing it. So, I won't say 100% I'll never do it again, but it probably would be one of the last things that I would do. Sugar dusting, not anymore. For roundtable number 3, I'll call this one Primordial Soup. I received a research paper with the title, A Cell Line Resource Derived from Honeybee Embryonic Tissues. I've talked before about the difficulties of reading some of these papers, and quite frankly, this one was so complicated I couldn't make heads or tails out of it. This thing came by way of Charles Ilsley, a member of my Beekeepers Association, and I thank him for that, but the clue to the context of what was being said in this was really a courtesy of Bob Kloss, who provided a link to a blog post that explained what the paper was about in English. It's pretty exciting, so thanks to both of them for the insights that I'm about to share with you. The topic at hand is about using cell cultures in research. In human history, being able to grow human cells independent of the body have provided the ability to change the course of mankind. For example, human cells were used to replicate the polio virus in a petri dish so that different approaches could be found for curing the disease. Cue Jonas Salk and the subsequent polio vaccine. Until recently, scientists were not able to generate a cell line for honeybees to use in research. Michael Goberich, a PhD student from University of Minnesota Bee Lab, was the first person able to establish a growing line of honeybee cells, and this is hugely important. These cells can be used to determine the impacts of pathogens or other means of using it. And in fact, Mike himself has been using what is deemed AME-711 honeybee cell line for his own work with Nosema. So time will tell how important this breakthrough is, but it seems this is a monumental step in bee research. So thanks to Michael for his efforts, and good luck to everyone who is working on this information. And I'll provide a link for New Cell Cultures Advance in Honey Bee Science. You can read a little more detail about this in the link in our show notes. Roundtable number 4, Michael Palmer video from the United Kingdom. A handful of podcast faithful sent me a link to a video of Michael Palmer speaking on the sustainable apiary. The lecture was published on December 7th, and it looks to parallel the presentation I referenced in our most recent episode. Mike continues to tune his presentation, and even if you make the investment to watch this video, which I highly recommend, don't forego the opportunity to see him in person. He is so worth it. Again, find a link in our show notes to the video. For roundtable number 5, we'll call this, Has This Ever Happened to You? So we have a lot of fun at our beekeeping executive meetings, and at the end of the last one that we had, we got on this topic about things that happened to us while beekeeping. And a couple of people shared some stories. Charlie Ilsley, who I just mentioned a moment ago, he had the pleasure of spilling a 5-gallon honey bucket in the back of his truck in my driveway, and it poured out all over the place. And what a mess it made. He was bringing it to a meeting where we were harvesting honey. He told the story about how he removed the honey from his truck. He pulled it into his yard when he got back home and just opened the doors and left it there. The indication was that the bees in his yard came and cleaned his truck up better than he could have ever dreamed of doing it himself. And there was honey everywhere, across the carpets in the back, underneath the seats, down inside the dry well in the back of the truck, everything that could get honey. And you know what a sticky, terrible mess that is to clean up. So an interesting story by Charlie. Barbara, our secretary, got stung between the eyes once, and then she went to work, and both her eyes swelled, and everybody was wholly concerned for her well-being, but she assured them that she would be perfectly fine, and within days she returned to normal. I know that experience myself, for I've been stung in the literal corner of my left eye, and it's closed shut, and I went to do a huge presentation at work in front of a good number of people. They were so distracted by what my eye appeared like that they just couldn't get past the presentation. And last but not least, Stan Wazitowski was talking about a simple job that he went to do where he went to move a couple hives in preparation for pollination. In the dark, he was setting up a yard, and the road tilted, and the hives fell off his trailer while he was trying to drive them. Not anticipating any problems, he had no veil, no gloves, no smoker, and 2 hives sitting on the ground, which had to be in operation in the morning. He sucked it up, he took his lumps, and he went in and he righted everything at the cost of his own peril, and it was a funny story. So my charge to you is, has this ever happened to you? Do you have any interesting beekeeping stories? I know one of the listeners sent something in one time about how they went out to check their apiary in shorts, and we'll never do that again. So head over to our Facebook page, facebook.com/beekeeperscorner, and leave us a note about some interesting things that have ever happened to you. And if we get some good ones, we'll share them back on the next episode. So roundtable number 6, this out of the New York Times, shared by Joe Devonshire out of New Jersey, one of the listeners. European agency warns of risk to humans in pesticides tied to bee deaths. Now this is a fascinating article and has the potential for global impact. European food regulators said that the pesticides, imidacloprid, one we know about, and acetamidiprid, they are safe to use in small amounts, but now they're saying that there's a potential for nervous system impact to human beings. This comes by way of European food regulators, who have a commission that is looking into this after a Japanese study raised similar concerns last year. Experts from the European Food Safety Authority are asking for guidance levels to be lowered while further research is carried out to provide more reliable data on this developmental neurotoxicity in the guise of protecting consumers and operators. The European Food Safety Authority goes as far as saying that they advise all neonicotinoid substances be evaluated as part of the testing strategy. Bayer, who makes imidacloprid, indicated through a spokesman that there is no developmental neurotoxicity potential in humans, and raised questions about the way the Japanese research was done. And the other company, Niso Chemical, has not been reached for comment, according to the New York Times. The statement that has the most interest to me is the one at the end from European Food Safety Authority that says, "Health concerns raised in the review of existing data are legitimate." That is an interesting statement that the European Union feels that there's further information to follow on here. The question is the EPA following from the United States? The EPA has been finally recognizing that pesticides do have an impact of honeybees, but now that there's a potential for impact to humans, you have to wonder if they're going to step up and get into the game here. I have this to think about, extrapolating this information, is this could have a huge global impact. If you think about neonicotinoids and the perverse use of these things across the globe to improve food science, if they somehow came to question where they had to be removed, it would change the entire landscape of how farming is done today. That's an interesting prospect of this, and this is certainly a story that will grow legs in 2014, and it'll be interesting to watch what happens as the European Union conducts this review. Roundtable topic number 7, Afghanistan beekeeping. Nick Jordan from the UK sent over some UK coverage of the beekeeping industry in Afghanistan. It was an article from the Telegraph along with a video shot. Very interesting perspective. One of the things I love most about watching videos like that is to see the beekeeping equipment that they use. The stuff is ratty and old and holes and cobbled together, but it doesn't matter to them. That's what they use. The video was somewhat amusing, where the reporter was getting stung and was told that the bees were docile, but apparently it looks like the reporter and the cameraman got lit up and the cameraman had to stand in. What's fascinating about the video is the impact that it's having to the Afghanistan communities. They were talking about people turning from opium farming to moving to beekeeping, and how lucrative it was covered as to how much the honey is worth and the typical amount of money that a family makes compared to what they can make if they are in the beekeeping industry. So you have to wonder if they would all turn to beekeepers, but I always love those short little vignettes of what beekeeping is like in another country. Thanks, Nick, for sharing that across. For roundtable number 8, I want to talk about the Ware Hive update. You may or may not recall that I'm looking into building a Ware Hive over the winter break here to put one in and get experience from it in the spring of 2014. I've been reading the Abbe Ware Beekeeping for All book, and one of the things I'm fascinated is that he goes into his experience and why he made the size of his hive the way it is, the way that it's designed, the approach that it's being used. And one of the things that strikes me is his commentary about other beekeepers at the time and how they derived their hives and how much cavity space they made in it. His commentary leads me to believe that smaller compact is more efficient. And I thought it really interesting that he literally measured the size of the interior and designed his box, which seems to be a little bit smaller than a Langstroth in dimensions. I've often wondered if a 10-frame box is the right answer, and if an 8-frame box is more correct. And if you look at the way the Ware hive is, it's also a little bit deeper than a conventional Langstroth hive. So I'm really interested in getting this hive out there and seeing how the bees respond to it. I do like the design of it, and now what I'm going to do is find the wood and get out there and get to building it. And to that end, I found something on the web called the Echo Bee Box. It's, I think, a company out of Utah. I posted a link over on our Facebook page. Very fascinating approach to have these small little tiny frames built in a box that's divided in half. It's almost like a nuke box, but it's longer and a little bit deeper. And it just looks fascinating to keep the bees in these little tiny frames. I'm not sure if it's an efficient use. And one of the things that I think I've gathered out of the Ware prospect is that the bees live in a barrel shape, and to put them in a long shape is not natural. Now, that don't send me hate mail if you have top bar hives, but it is fascinating to think about the way that these people have constructed different hives, and that's one of the things I'm looking for, is to figure out whether the bees care if they're horizontal or vertical and how much the cavity space is. Whether actually we put all these hives out there in the yard and can discern that by casual observation. The one thing that I get from this and other books that I read from people who are insightful, they have hands-on practical experience every day. Another book that I'm currently reading, the writer is talking about how he goes out and follows his hives through the spring by literally going out and listening at 7 at night when the sun goes down, and 1 in the morning, and going in at 5 in the morning, and hearing whether the bees are operational and drying honey in the box, and listening for chirping sounds of queens that are ripe and ready to harvest for a swarm. That's how they're doing their apiary management to try and derive the most honey flow. That to me is like, wow, I'm going to get up at 4 in the morning and go out and put an ear to my hive? That seems rather extreme. I don't know if I want to go to that extent, but that's the extent that some of these people who are providing this insight have gone to. And for that, I go back and say on this Ware hive thing, yes, our science and our information and our learning has progressed so much. But again, what's old is new. This is a theme that I've covered here before, and it's just fascinating to go back to these people who spent so much time. In my estimation, somebody like Ware is like the Michael Bush of old times, where they just lived, breathed, and ate this stuff constantly. And anyway, a little insight from the Ware book, very fascinating. On a related note, recently I posted a neat idea to deter ants with PVC caps from the hives. There's been all this conjecture on different sources I've seen over time where people have been building these contraptions that prevent things from climbing up from the ground and getting into the hive. A lot of them involve some sort of chamber on a post that holds liquids, and the ants or whatever the creature is can't cross this liquid. In the one book that I'm reading right now, The Art of Beekeeping by Ormond Albee, A-L-B-E-I, they went through this whole practice of trying to deter them and talking about how ingenious the insects were. In one case, somehow the ants were able to drop onto the hive and crawled from the top down and created a link of bodies that created a bridge that they crossed to thwart the moat that the person had created. The other thing that occurred was rain got in and overflowed the liquid, or it dried out if it was water. So all these fascinating approaches. Beekeepers are really smart to try and figure out how to keep things from traversing up from the hive. I know in the past I've had a lot of problems, especially in the one location, with ants just totally overtaking the inner cover. And it frustrated me, and it was something that as soon as I moved that hive out of that area, it went away. I'm not sure what it was specific about that particular spot that caused this, but I bet I could sympathize with a lot of you out there that have these problems and are looking for solutions. So go check out our Facebook page. There's a neat idea link there. And if you know of any of these type of contraptions or traps that you could send to us, it'd be great to point those out to others who I'm sure share in your pain and frustration. So roundtable number 9, let's call this the last one. In one of the recent episodes, I mentioned about a drape and its use, and along with a quiet box. These ideas came from Billy Davis from SustainableBees.com. Billy is an EAS master beekeeper. If you go to our Facebook page, facebook.com/beekeeperscorner, that's facebook.com/beekeeperscorner, posted a couple notes over there on November 5th to show you what these things look like so you can get an idea, because when you see them, it's always a lot easier to understand the concept. So go take a look at those and follow up to one of our most recent episodes. So that seems enough for today. Let's get to closing comments. With this episode, I broke a run of 2-week durations between releases. Now, 3 weeks isn't a sin, but I guess all good things have to come to an end. As always, end-of-year activities at work and community organizations mean busy nights and occupied weekends, and finding time to put everything together becomes a challenge on occasion. I have to say that I find myself challenged lately with topics for the podcast, not because I don't have things to cover, but I have far too many, and I seem to be a little distracted trying to figure out which ones should come to prominence. Each of the ideas has merit on its own, but quite frankly, I wanted to do the winter follow-up in this episode, and I just didn't have all the content organized together in 2 weeks to be able to record that, so another week to round it out, flush it out, clean it up, make it a little bit better, and hopefully the content is better for it. You know, it's a difficult thing sometimes to find an article and use that as the basis of your reporting, and then go back and try and flush it out and make sure you have accuracy and all the little side notes that come through. You have to go fact check them and find information on it. So, yeah, too much information, I guess. I suppose I share these things so you have some insights on what goes on behind the scenes. And it answers the question, where the heck were you last week? Which I know people were thinking even if they didn't send me notes. So anyway, it's a week before Christmas and I have all my shopping done. I still have a reasonable run of winter bee projects to do, and a holiday break that will take me into next year before I have to go back to work. I'll do some bee things, and I'll leave some for later in the spring, and I'll spend time with my family instead of living in the garage working on hive projects. You know, there's always the spring scramble to keep that jittery feeling away when you know spring is coming and you're really looking forward to getting out in the apiary again. I guess one always gets sentimental and reflection comes through this time of year, and it's been a great year of beekeeping. Maybe not so prolific in the stance of bees and hives and honey and all that, but I feel fortunate that my interest is as high as ever. We have our health, a great marriage, the career is going well, I enjoy my work, the family is great, and we have a new dog. I don't know if I mentioned that. Her name is Julia. She is a chocolate lab terrier mix. She's so cute. How Norman Rockwell can you get? So for everybody, I wish you the best this holiday season. I feel fortunate for the friends and acquaintances that we've made through the podcast, and I am truly grateful for the support that's shown to the effort. Thank you for your notes and your kind words, for sharing the insights and sharing articles and things like that. Keep them coming. I'd love to have them all. I might try and sneak one more episode in this year, but I think what I want to do is in direct conflict with all the things that I have to do and the amount of time that's available to me. So this might very well be the last podcast for the year. We'll leave that up to the podcast gods. So if this is the final episode of the year, I will take the opportunity to wish everyone a joyous holiday and a happy new year. Thank you for listening to the Beekeeper's Corner podcast. Until we meet again, take care and be well.